Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Hello and welcome to the weekend podcast on this bank holiday weekend into February. Yay! Follow us on Spotify for this weekly selection of my favourite chats from the last couple of days right now. And on this episode, we've a moving interview with domestic abuse survivor Lisa O'Mara, Veep creator Armando Iannucci, and the No Worries If Not comedians bring some merry mayhem into studio. First up, however, the inspiring Lisa O'Mara, the young Offaly mother whose story stopped our listeners in their tracks. She suffered a nightmare relationship with a man who's now been jailed for 14 and a half years, though he is appealing his conviction. But Lisa is free now, and she came in to tell us of how love bombing lured her into the relationship, and then the coercive control and the abuse she suffered. But there were tears of happiness too, as she revealed rekindling with a friend that she had been tricked into disconnecting from. It really was a difficult story to tell, but one that she was telling for a very, very good reason, because her message to other women and men in abusive relationships: don't stay, just leave. She was incredible. After that, we met the comedy genius Armando Iannucci. He is the man behind Veep, The Thick of It. You'll know him really well. In fact, he helped create Alan Partridge in The Day Today. And he was with us to discuss bringing Dr. Strangelove to the stage, a live theatrical presentation with Steve Coogan in the starring role where Peter Sellers once dwelled. It opened in the West End last October in London. It's coming to Dublin for a fortnight, and we had a great chat about Armando's Glasgow upbringing, his Italian father, his fascination with daft political language, and many of our listeners, in fact, joined in with such phrases as "let me be very clear," and he enjoyed all of that too. And then to end, the comedians behind the No Worries If Not sketch series, they come in for a bit of aimless conversation really: Killian Sunderman, Michael Fry and Justine Stafford. And what did we chat about? Well, we discussed creepy owlfellas, the two very different Meath accents, Killian's German origins, and the allure of powerful grannies who can make things happen with crumpled up fivers. So we have very serious stories mingling with the light relief there. So happy St. Bridget's weekend to you all, and into the podcast we go. And another warning that there is distressing content and strong language in this interview, but it is important to hear. Lisa O'Mara courageously waived her right to anonymity following a nightmare relationship at the hands of her former partner, Barry Murphy. The 39-year-old man of Shamrock House, Grogan, Ballycumber, County Offaly, he was sentenced last December to 14 and a half years in prison. He is guilty of coercively controlling, of raping, assaulting and falsely imprisoning Lisa between February 2018 and July 2020. This is her story as told here yesterday. Now, I wanted to find out a little bit about her at the beginning. So the first thing I asked was about who Lisa O'Mara was back in 2018, who we'd get to know if we met her back then.
Well, before I met Barry, I would have classed myself as happy, carefree. I was out every weekend with my friends. I was enjoying my life. Like, I had a great circle of friends, close friends, and I was very close to my ma, my dad, my family, just everybody. It was all close connect, like. But, you know, I was only 23, 24, like, yeah. So I had my whole life ahead of me, like, so I was just day by day kind of girl, like.
And this is in County Offaly?
Offaly, yeah.
And the parents, were you living in the town, or were you townies or Colchies?
No, I'm Colchies.
You're a proud Colchie.
I'm a proud Colchie, yeah.
And so you're out and about, you're social, and you're obviously someone who loves the chats and loves a very, very social girl. So you start seeing him in 2018. How do you meet, first of all?
Through another friend, so mutual friends. Mm. That's how we met. And then it kind of went to him texting me on Facebook. That's where it had started off then.
A normal start for relationships. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the love bombing begins.
Love bombing begins. It starts with telling you what you want to hear, but it's also gifts, hotels, like going away, you know. Yeah, there was all of that at the start, like.
It's easy to fall immediately for this version because you obviously believe this is who he really is.
Yeah.
Someone who's going to look after you, care for you.
Yeah, but there was also things at the start, like, that I see now and I'm looking back, like, it was little red flags. Like, I had women texting me, telling me things like that they were with him and the whole lot. He was engaged when I met him. I didn't know.
Wow.
Like, there was a lot, like, but he was so good at manipulating people, he knew what to say and the right thing to say. And I just kind of like, I just shoved it off. Like, I believed him, like, over everyone else that was telling me about him, like.
And generally, it's like, those people are mad.
Yeah, so they're crazy. Like, what I am now, I'm crazy. I'm making it all up. Like, it's just all lies. Everything's a lie. That's why he built his life on lies.
So you discredit people, and then so anything they say to you, you're not going to believe.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. Do you remember when his true character starts to emerge?
I don't remember the very start of it, but like slowly but surely creeps more and more in. Like, it's coming to, there was a time there where me and my best friend fell out because he had told me he was with her. And I was believing him and I turned on her. So that was our friendship gone like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this is classic manipulation, separating you from people who can talk.
Like family, everyone, like, you know.
In hindsight, it's incredibly clever, isn't it?
It is very clever. Like, yeah, he turns you away from the most people that's around you. And then that's where you're stuck then. You're stuck with the abuser because that's all you're used to is him, like.
That's normal life.
That's normal life, yeah.
By the way, did you manage to rekindle with that friend since? Or?
I have, yeah.
That's another.
And I'm delighted, like. It's just getting my life back.
Good to hear, because you've been through a lot. And we'll touch on some of it. There are pictures shown in court and they've since been published. I've seen that. They're absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
Violent injuries to your face.
Yeah, I think it happened the end of, I think it was around February, I think it was the end of January, February, but I remember May and we were all out in, we were having a barbecue out in the garden, like, but I still had black eyes come May, like, and all family and everything there as well, like, but yeah, it was fairly severe, broken nose. I have a scar on my eye as well. He kind of probably kickboxing, and my eye slit. So I had to get stitches in my eye as well to, because so I wouldn't set back, if you get me, like.
So was it daily?
It wasn't daily, no. It was kind of when drink was involved. Mm. But like, it wasn't every day, that's the thing about it, like. But there was always something every day. And that could be ringing you on the phone, wanting to know where you are, who you're with, what you're doing and why you're with them. Like, it had gone to a stage where I was half afraid, like, even my ma ringing me. Oh, what's she doing ringing you, like? What are you doing talking to her, like? You know? Like, I'd half afraid to pick up my phone, even though I had nothing to hide.
Yeah.
I'd just be afraid to pick up the phone because he'd be looking at me.
This is the cloud of control that takes over your life, isn't it? So everything is frightening. Yeah. Everything's a risk.
Yeah. But yet, like, if it's the other way around, he can do what he wanted, when he wanted, where he could disappear for the night. He could go text anyone, like, whatever he wanted to do, he done it. But when it comes to me, like, no.
I mean, how does it begin? I mean, you obviously live in this nightmare. For people who are outside of it, sometimes they don't understand how people stay. But it's very incremental, isn't it? Little by little, separated from family and friends.
Yeah, like, that's the control thing, I think, the course of control. Knowing, like, manipulators know how to slowly take control without even realising it's happening.
At the time you're going through this, are you able to, you know, are you able to work? Are you able to associate with other people? What is your life like?
I was working when I met him. I was a barmaid, kind of restaurant, serving food and things like that. And he'd always end up coming into my workplace, bringing friends with him, sitting down, drinking, like, so that didn't turn out well for me. And then I got fired from that place, went to another place, a barmaid, that like that again. He came in again, started drinking at the bar with his friends, and like that, I got fired as well. So, like,
no facet of your life was really free of him.
No, but he'd always say, oh, you don't need to work, you have me. So, like, that was another control thing, like, you know.
Doesn't much to build a life.
Yeah.
Outside of his sphere.
Yeah.
You start drinking yourself.
We would drink at night time, yeah. I think it was just because of the fact that he was doing it, like, and it was just the two of us that was there. But.
Well, it's typical of victims that they find solace, don't they, in something that's going to numb.
Numb, yeah.
Everything you're going through.
But he would drink every night now. It wouldn't be a case where I would have now, but every night, like. between either drinking at home. Now, it came to a stage where he had the ban, or the, not the ban, he had a curfew. So he had to be in for 10 o'clock every night. So he was drinking in the house every night, but it was before that, it was in pubs and the whole lot, like.
Sorry, the curfew?
Yeah, he had a curfew because he broke his bar in order with me. So the curfew, he had a curfew and other things. He couldn't leave the country because he was a lorry driver, so he wasn't allowed to leave the country because of the case that was coming up. Like,
these are issues that we hear about.
Yeah.
You're kept away from family and friends. What do they say now to you, what was going through their heads at the time?
Well, they wanted me to leave, but I was madly in love, like, whatever it was. It wasn't love anyway, but...
Well, you were in love with that initial fake idea, yeah.
What he had painted himself out to be at the start. But I was afraid as well because certain things happened as well. Like, I had to get cameras up in my house. My parents had to get cameras. Like, if I wouldn't speak to him, he'd land at my nanny's house, he'd go to my ma's house. If I was avoiding him, like, he'd hop the phone over, he'd ring the whole time. But, like, my family just wanted me away from him, but I couldn't get away from him.
These are the moments where you do get away the odd time, but you go back. Can you tell us about, I mean, it's something like out of a spy movie, really, the contacting a friend using Facebook.
On the telly, yeah. Because I had no phone, so... He was gone to the pub and obviously locked the door behind him when he went out.
He takes your phone away.
I didn't have a phone at that time.
Okay.
He obviously took it, but I didn't have one at that time. And so he went to the pub and locked the door. And that's when I...
Locked the door?
Yeah, he always locked the back door behind him.
Okay.
Yeah. The front door was screwed shut. And... yeah, so he locked the door, and then I remember, I think it was that night when he came in, I was making the soup and bread, and he was like, "Where's mine?" I was like, "Well, sure, you can have this if you want it." And he just picked up the whole bowl and plate and just threw it and smashed it against the wall, like, for no absolute reason at all. Like,
this is the night you plot some level of escape.
Yeah, I got onto the telly and logged on to Facebook and was texting, and I wouldn't mind. It was taking ages because the remote and, like, the way the telly was, I was kind of half afraid he was going to come in as well.
Right.
So I was trying to hurry up, but a girl he was with previously who contacted me when we were abroad on holidays, that's who I contacted to get me out of house. So she organised a taxi then. And when he came back, he fell asleep. So I got the keys.
Right.
And I opened the door and left then.
And you're away for...
Couple of weeks, and then I went back again because he was on the phone. I was at home and he landed out of the house with a big bunch of flowers, and my ma and dad was there, and Mara went mental. She's like, "Get the away from my door," like. And at that time, like, I was still torn. I wanted to take the flowers and I didn't want to take the flowers. That was the whole control thing, like.
It's classic. It's the it's love bombing again, isn't it? And this is the version you wanted to believe.
Yeah.
And they're very good at pretending that they can be that person.
Like, he was sorry, and but then, like, he'd never be specific of what he was sorry for. He was just sorry and it wouldn't happen again. And things will change and this, that and the other and the whole lot. But he'd only say that. And then it'd be back to square one there after a week or two, like, when we get back together.
This is the moment where it comes to people asking, why don't you leave fully then? Can you explain that fear? Because you got the love bombing, which brings you back into his control.
Yeah.
Can you explain what that fear was like of, you know, that detains you from getting fully free of this man?
Well, it's the love bombing. It's trauma bond, I suppose. Like, it's holding on to something that I was holding on to something. I don't know what I was holding on to, but that's the control thing. Like, but... Like, I was afraid for myself, my family, because I knew what he was like and what he was capable of doing. Like, so I was afraid for myself, my family.
And you had kids to look after, and
and
thought this was the best way.
Yeah, heard and seen a lot too, like, you know, at such a young age. Like, but I was terrified to stay and I was terrified to go. So I was like, what do I do? I didn't know what to do, so I just said I'd stay. Just protect my family and protect myself. Because if I stayed with him, then he won't go near my family, you know? That's... And my kids, like, I wasn't... I stayed for them, more or less, like, but I was...
So even the wider family, you thought that if at least he's somewhat placated here, he's not going to be a threat to anyone outside.
Yeah. Because that's what I'd always go back to, is my family or my belongings, my house. Like, that's, it always goes back to that. So I was trying to keep everything, like, okay with him.
Can we get you tissues?
Are
you okay?
Please.
Yeah, if you don't mind. Some tissues in here, not at all.
But, like, I feel like when I said the last time, just leave. Like, it's not about just leaving. Like, there's a whole story to that. Like, the first step is leaving and letting go of the control. Like, just cut contact is the best thing. It's hard. Like, it really is hard. It took me years to do it and stick to it. Because it's only when he got locked up there that I actually got myself back.
When did Gardaí become involved in your case?
So when we had our argument that night, or when that picture of my face that night, I had sent it to a friend before my phone went out, and she got the picture and she ended up letting my man know, and she went to the guards and made a statement. And I think it was 2 or 3 days later then the guards found us. But in the mix of all of that, he won't let me go home because of the fact of my face.
That so I was in the house. Evidence of his violence was
so
there.
So I was in the house.
When the Gardaí first come then in 2019?
Yeah, they first came and they were calling my name, but sure, I didn't want to go. I stayed in the room, like, I didn't want to go out. And what happened was, basically, I ended up finding a key up in the press and opened the back door. And I had to be brought to Fields, because the guards were stopping cars at the top of the road, all in around the area, searching the cars, searching the boots to look for me, because obviously they wanted a welfare check and wanted to check on me, but they couldn't find me. So then...
And is he bringing you here and there to avoid the guards? Or
yeah.
You,
yeah. Yeah. So he wasn't there. He was gone in a lorry. And there was a car waiting for me on the road. So when I got into that car brought me to him in the lorry.
Right.
And so then I think we stayed in the lorry the first night, or a hotel. The next day he went into Penny's and he got me a jacket and he got me a peak hat. Like, the jacket came up around, like, your ears there, like, so it was well covered. And then I had a peak hat, and then he went in and got me antihistamines to take down the swelling on my face. Like,
we now know that the very worst happened. You're subject to the most horrific sexual violence by Barry Murphy. How was he towards you after those occasions?
Just, like, numb. I was numb to it, but he just didn't care.
Carried on as if nothing.
Just carried on, like, just walk out the door. Like, I remember just laying down on the couch and he just, what's wrong with you? And I didn't even say nothing. I was just wrapped in a blanket and I was just like, what is wrong with you? Like, could you not know what you've just done? Like, and no care in the world. Like, oh, what's wrong with you? Walk out the door then. Like, nothing happened.
And again, it's because the abuser will ensure that you blame yourself.
Yeah. Like, there was another night there where I was not in the main room, in the spare room, because I didn't want to sleep in with him. Like, and he had a friend over, and so he went to bed and I went into the spare room, and he was shouting down at me to come down to the room, come down here now, come down here. And I wouldn't answer him, I wouldn't go down. And then his friend was sitting on the couch, like, going to sleep, like. And he starts shouting, oh, you go in there and ride her. So that's all she's there for. You go in there, sure. She won't come down to me, so you go in there. And I just roared in the bed. I felt, like, so small. I was like, I'm a human fucking being. I have feelings at the end of the day. Like, how can anyone turn around and say something like that? Oh, go in and ride her. Like, yeah, we're supposed to be in a relationship.
It's disgusting.
Yeah. I felt, and, like, even his friend turned around and, like, whispered, are you okay? I just didn't answer because I didn't know what to say, and I didn't want to get me into trouble if I said anything back to him either. So I just stayed silent.
You mentioned a barring order earlier. What was that exactly for?
There was a few now throughout the couple of years. I'm not exactly, like, even before I had my girls, like, there was barring orders, protection orders. There was a few of them now, but I went into the guards and took all them back. But There was, we were in court in Athlone and the case was up and I was up in the box trying to say, oh no, it's okay, everything's all right, we're back together and the whole lot. And they just said, no, I'm not lifting the barren order. This is too serious. Which I thanked now, like, you know. Yeah. But that was him in my head, oh, go up and say this and go up and say that. And I was, the more I think about it now, like, I'm more ashamed of myself for letting him do that to me, like, because it's me picking up the pieces after, like, he's still in his head, he still thinks he's done nothing wrong.
Well, he's in your head, it's not really you, isn't it, that
yeah.
you're just totally controlled.
Yeah.
The pattern of manipulation and abuse, we've heard the barring orders, all these kind of efforts, the guards calling to you, avoiding really the protection there, but eventually it all comes to the fore and eventually you do get free.
Yeah.
Well, what happens in the end? What is the cattle? What's the moment that breaks you free?
When he got locked up, it really opened up my eyes, because I was like, it killed me when he did get locked up, and I was like letting a piece of me go. Like, it was really hard, because I still in my head, I loved him, like. And I had two girls. I had one girl and I was pregnant also as well. So I had a lot of emotions going on. But as time went on, I was slowly but surely getting my life back. I started a new job. I got back talking to my best friend. Like, so much. And then I just thought to myself, like, why didn't I do this long ago? Why didn't, like, I had to break free, like, I had to stop getting dragged along, because the only way I can describe it is if someone is putting your head underwater, leaving you for so long and then letting you back up. It's just like, it's a relief.
Mm-hmm. And the second child you have with him, he's never met her. Because he was in prison.
Yeah, he's never met her and he will never have anything got to do with my kids anyway. I was holding on to something. I was holding on to my little family.
Yeah.
But at the end of it all, I knew it wasn't a family. Like, it was me holding on to something. That's the trauma bond.
And presumably they are, God love them, too young to remember any of this.
Molly was only one when he got locked up. So she doesn't own. It's just me and my family, like, you know.
You've two kids from a previous relationship, but it's been very difficult for them.
Yeah, especially my daughter now, because she's obviously the oldest, so she heard a lot and she's seen a lot. Like,
he's got a very long sentence, although he is appealing.
He is appealing
the conviction.
Yeah.
In court, he refused to accept the jury's findings.
Yeah, but yet he said it was a domestic situation that got around. So. How does that make sense? Like,
it on paper, as I say, it looks like a short time period, 2018 to into 2020.
Yeah.
But it sounds almost like what you've described, like decades of mayhem.
Oh yeah.
Chaos.
Yeah.
Violence. You're still very badly affected. We can.
Oh, I
hear
am.
In your voice.
I am, and I think I always will be. I think it's because I will always be connected to him because of my girls. So I look at them, I see him every day. And so I they're the best thing in the world. Like, I don't regret, because I don't think I'd be here if it wasn't for my kids.
Mm. It's still very recent.
Yeah.
Very, very fresh in your mind, because the case and everything last year, the sentencing only a few weeks ago. I mean, I believe things will get better for you.
Yeah, I'm on the right track. Like, I'm with the best family and friends and support, doctors, everything, like even the guards as well, my liaison officers, everyone. Like, they're great, but I pushed them away. I pushed all of them away because of him.
Mm. And you realise now that they wanted to listen to you and there was help there.
They knew, they could see it. They could see what was happening, but I couldn't. They could see it all, but then, like, as Ma said, I'm just going to have to stop talking to you if you're going to stay with him, like, so. I ended up did staying with him, but, like, I'm over the worst of it now anyway. It was a long time coming. Like, I think it was because of COVID and everything. It's just the whole.
It's a slow process,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's a very slow process, but it's worth it in the end.
some people are fearful of that process. I mean, if they're you 5 years ago more, and this is who you want to talk to, really, isn't it? Women out there who think that they can keep going back, that it will improve things.
Yeah.
The worst is over. People will remember you standing outside court. And it's incredible when I watch back, you're off the cuff. You're speaking to people directly, to women. Just leave, it's not going to get better.
Yeah, but like that's what I say, just leave. It's easier said than done to just leave. Like, it takes a lot.
Just leave, you have to leave. Don't stay, it doesn't get better. It just gets worse and worse. Don't be afraid, speak up.
Don't be afraid to speak up. That's the start, is speaking up and breaking away. It is possible. It's hard, it's a lengthy process, but it's worth everything, because I feel like I was being silenced for years while trying to keep his pride. I've said that in my victim impact statement. All he was ever worried about was being on the news or being on the papers, or he was always worried about himself and what he has, and like materially, like house, cars. That's all he worries about, like. But
incredible insecurity.
Yeah.
You said as well in your victim impact statement that you were very proud of the fact that you got there, got into court to confront your abuser.
Yeah.
So it's the pride you got to hold on to now, isn't it?
Well, I am strong. I was strong before I met him and he broke me down. But I'm getting back to myself slowly but surely. I'm taking back control, because that's what he thrives off, is control.
What about you? What is your life like right now?
I'm happy. I had a good Christmas, quiet Christmas, first one in years, because there was always something at Christmas time. But I'm working about a year now. I'm just enjoying quiet time.
You work among books?
I work among books, I do, yeah.
It's busy, you'd say, Christmas in a bookshop.
But it's great, like, we're a great team in there, like, all the girls. The management, the whole lot, like, they've been so good to me as well, like, this year. Because I've obviously had to take time off and things like that. But they've been amazing. The girls are great. Like, I'm back, getting back to myself. I'm out talking to people, like, whether I was shut off for so long, like. But now I'm living my life. I don't care about anything or anyone. Once I'm okay and my kids are okay, and that's my priority now. That's what I'm looking after.
There must be little moments in your day when you're just able to go out and get a cup of coffee or walk outside, take a
call. I started the gym. I did. me and my friend go, like, it's just good, like, for head-wise as well. But I'm a totally different girl than I was 2 years ago. And I'm proud to say that as well. And I'm happy to say it. And I'm not to be ashamed of now, like, not a thing to be ashamed of.
Do you know that? Because there are times where, even in our conversation, you're really mad at yourself. But you have to understand that it was never your fault.
It was never my fault. And that's like what I've come to terms with, because we went through the trial, we had a jury. That was all done, like. So I wasn't lying. I got my side of the story out, like. And I think it was when the trial was going on as well, I didn't hold back either. Mm-hmm. Like, when I was up in the box, like, his defence was like, I was like, no. It's like, I'm a human being, I have feelings.
The truth is easy sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, but you always slip up and you tell lies anyway. Exactly. So, like, it didn't go well for him anyway, because when you lie from the start, it's just not going to end very well anyway. But
do you think you'd be able to kind of quench the anger?
Me? Mm. I think with time, yeah. I think with time, like that's what I kick myself the most, is just, why did I put up with it for so long? Why didn't I listen to everyone? Why didn't I just leave? But that's what it is. It's the trauma bond. It's holding on, because you have him and only him. And you had nobody else. Like, they take you away from your family. They take you away from your friends. So, like,
you found the courage.
Yeah.
And you confronted him. That must have been some moment for you to confront him in court.
Yeah. It was hard. Now, and I read out my victim impact statement as well in the court. I was offered someone to read it, but I wanted to read it. And I wanted to look at him and read it at the same time. Because this is what I've been trying to tell him for years, was how he made me feel. But he'd never listen.
he had to listen this
time. He had to listen this time. And I wasn't going to do it, but the more I thought about it, it's like, this is my last chance to say what I want to say to him. Not him telling me, I'm telling him. Like he always used to say to me, no one will ever overpower me. I'll always win. And so, like I said that in, I think, in my victim impact statement as well, he said, no one will ever overpower you, but I got my power back.
The bullies That's, crumble when you do
yeah.
in front of last.
Yeah.
What's the name of your friend who you read?
Megan. Megan, yeah.
That's a powerful friendship name.
Oh, it's... I'll cry if we talk about it.
Happy tears this time.
Happy tears. I'm just happy to have her back. Like, we've been friends for like 10 years, so that was so hard. Like, I missed out on her pregnant, having her baby, the two babies. Like, I missed out on the whole lot. But I'm there now and we're like...
You're back, you're free.
We're like, never
do whatever you want. You have your life back, don't you?
Yeah.
A major part of the healing and recovery is forgiving yourself for staying, isn't it? And realising none of that was your fault.
That's kind of it. Forgive yourself. Because I need to keep telling myself, you did nothing wrong. You did nothing wrong. Like, that's... Don't be ashamed. Don't be embarrassed. Because I was. I was ashamed and embarrassed for letting him do that. And there are obviously still going to be moments, but I've overcome a lot. If you see me 2 years ago, you'd think, wow, like...
And if we see you in 2 years' time,
yeah,
it'd be different again. Lisa Absolutely. Mara, you're just incredible for coming in. Thank you so much. I know it was difficult, but I know you're doing it for other people as well.
Yeah.
And to waive that right of yours, absolute right to remain anonymous, is just going to help a lot of people out there. And it holds to account all abusive partners, not just your own. So it's an incredible public service, basically, yeah. that you've done.
I just want to say, I sure. want to get the message across to any man or woman in any abusive relationship that there is help and support out there to get out of these situations. This is just please take the first step and reach out for help. I am living proof you can get out. You can get justice for yourself and make a better life for yourself too. It's not easy. I'm still suffering from the trauma. Like, I do have PTSD. I'm medicated and the whole lot, but I am getting myself back. I'm getting my life back. I'm taking back control.
Well, it's a good time for me to say that anyone affected by the discussion, they can contact the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. That's 1800 778 888, 1800 778 888, anytime, day or night. And rt.ie/helplines has other support as well. Thanks a million again, Lisa O'Mara.
Thank you.
Good luck to you and to all your family. Big and small, wish you every success in among the books and everything.
Yeah.
And every strength as well for the year ahead. So
absolutely.
You have a life to live now, so we'll let you off. Be proud of yourself.
I will every day be proud.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Lisa O'Mara, they're obviously an inspiring woman, and no surprise, the messages are all love and support for her. We've given the time to her this morning, but we will go through every single message and make sure she knows that appreciation and bring you a longer selection in tomorrow's show. And as with these kind of cases, we often hear from people much later in the day after they've had the chance to reflect. But most of all, this story is for the women and the men in abusive relationships out there, thinking and dreaming that it's going to get better, blaming themselves. You shouldn't, and it won't. There is a small sample of the correspondence I'll give you. I'm in awe of this woman's courage and ability to finally escape from that dreadful situation. Another, you have nothing to be ashamed of. The shame is all his. You are so strong. I'm in tears listening to this beautiful, intelligent girl. I wish her so much happiness and strength, which she clearly has. God bless. We gave the Dublin Rape Crisis number there. I also want to give Women's Aid, which is 1800 341 900, 1800 341 900. It's a 24-hour service as well. rt.ie/helplines have tons of other places as well, supports that are available for each and every case. I'll finish with this message. It says, being the parent of an adult child in an abusive relationship is the loneliest place to be. While they're in the relationship, you have to go along with it so they have somewhere to run to. And in our case, go along with a wedding with broken hearts. We're out of it now, but my advice for anyone is to keep in touch no matter what. This advice to the parents of an adult child in an abusive relationship. They need you, but they may fiercely resist your efforts to rescue them. Keep in touch. Be the contrast in their lives. And they say Women's Aid was a great help. There are many more messages. There's one from a male victim there, but I wouldn't do it justice if I rush through it now. We will return to this tomorrow. Our thanks once again to Lisa O'Mara and her family. But Welcome back. My next guest is a legend of political satire, the creative force behind the Day Today, Veep, The Thick of It, The Death of Stalin, the personal history of David Copperfield. That was brilliant. He was there for the birth of Alan Partridge, no less, and many, many more. He's got HBO series piling out of him, the movie industry at his feet, but he's doing something very unusual, a stage show, a live adaptation of one of the funniest films ever made, Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, starring Steve Coogan. And it's been in the West End and very well received over there since the autumn. And next week it comes to Dublin, straight to Dublin. Armando Iannucci, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that summary of my career. I feel rather kind of under a lot of pressure now to live up to that.
It almost sometimes feels like an obituary at times, isn't it, doing intros for people on the radio? I've come to learn. But
I'm very much alive.
Yeah, very much alive. And doing a theatre show. By the way, yeah. Are you settling nicely into Dublin? Have you just got here? What?
I arrived yesterday, but I've been here many times. Usually on my way to the Catlaps, to the Kilkenny Festival.
Oh, yeah, gosh. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Your familiar face and panels.
Good,
and
memorable times there, yeah.
And you've come to town kind of surprisingly early. The show opens next week in the mm-hmm. Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. Mm-hmm. Is there work to be done moving in production from the West End to Dublin that you have to be?
I think the work is the cast just having a well-earned rest. They've been going for like 4 months at the Norcow Theatre in London, who told us last week that we were the most successful play they've had on in the history of that theatre.
Really?
Centuries at that place. Steve particularly, because in the film, Dr. Strange, those who haven't seen the film, and it's an amazing film, it's set in the 1960s, the Cold War, Britain, America, and the Soviet Union as it then was. And a mad general starts a process that could lead to all-out nuclear annihilation. It's very funny. And Peter Sellers plays three roles in the film. Yeah, famously, and Steve has upped that. He's playing all of Peter Sellers' roles, but he's also playing a fourth role, one that was offered to Peter Sellers in the film, and he said he couldn't do. So Steve
in an edited film, and yeah. It's on stage.
And of course, in the film, Peter Sellers could do one part 1 week and another part another week, and they just cut it together. So on stage, we have to somehow get Steve in four different places at once, which is part of the challenge and, of course, the fun of it.
So he needs this little bit of time off.
So after 4 months of that, he's having a little rest, and then he'll be back up and buzzing next week.
We're quite chuffed here because normally this would be part of a touring company, maybe with a different cast. It rarely comes directly from West End.
Yeah, yeah, and they were all up. The invite came very early on last year, and we thought, yeah, great. Good to do, and the cast are all looking forward to next week onwards.
And I presume you know how the thirst for political stuff in Ireland is very deep from your visits here.
It is weird that we started working on the adaptation about 2 years ago thinking, well, nuclear weapons, it's not top of the agenda at the moment, but maybe it's a metaphor for, you know, climate emergency and whatever. And then we opened to, you know, Putin, Ukraine. There's even the mad general in the film. Starts the whole thing off because he's worried that someone is interfering in American water with fluoride in the water.
That's extraordinary.
And now we've got JFK Jr.
RFK
this Jr. day, RFK Jr. this day talking about fluoridation and how it's a threat.
It's going to take all the fluoride out.
Yes, yes. We don't want to be infecting America's teeth by the back door. No.
Someone's rotting teeth. I wonder has he invested somewhere on indentures? You never know. But I presume you've been watching that those Senate hearings or him being questioned.
Off and on. I mean, the play itself posits a very weird, deranged world in which, you know, accidents might happen if the wrong people are in charge. And then you watch what's on the screen in your telly happening live in front of you, and you are shocked by how little you have to travel to get to the absurdity of the play.
Yeah, literally a health secretary incoming who doesn't believe in science, it seems.
Yeah, or vaccines.
He's saying otherwise, we must point out.
Yes, we ought to fact check that. That's still allowed.
Did you drink up the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis or anything like that? Because that's kind of where Stanley Kubrick was, and that's where his head was when he came up with this.
That's where he was, and we've... I mean, the interesting thing is, and this is the whole play was really at the invitation of the Kubrick family and the Kubrick estate, who've never done an adaptation of a Kubrick movie before. So this is their first ever venture into that. And they were very keen that, you know, we celebrate and honour the film, but also they give us access to all the archives, the Kubrick archives of early drafts. And there was a serious version that he wrote of the film. Very, very dramatic. But the more he explored it, and it was all about mutually assured destruction, or MAD, as it was officially called, MAD, that, you know, if nothing will happen because if we've got weapons, they've got weapons, they know if they fire their weapons, we'll fire ours and everyone will die. So that's not going to happen. MAD. And the more he explored it, the more he realised it had to be done as a comedy because it was just so absurd. So we've taken that a little bit further.
Do you meddle much? Do we? Because there are some famous scenes in the film that people will be looking out for.
You know, and it's very much mindful of the fact that a lot of people won't have seen the film and you're not expected to. You know, it's an entertainment, it's a show on its own. If it makes you go back and watch the film, great. But fundamentally, and it's Steve Coogan at the peak of his powers, four different characters simultaneously, and an amazing cast around him, and there are the odd hints to what's happening now. I mean, we're still set in the 1960s, but there are the odd heightened references to things going on now.
That's what we expect.
Yes.
So he plays the American president.
American president. He plays an English RAF officer who's in an American Air Force base with the Mad General trying to stop him. He plays Dr. Strangelove, who's a German scientist who's now working with NASA, or as he pronounced it, NASA, on various bits of lethal technology. And in the film, there is this other character, Colonel Kong. I mean, all the names,
the names are hilarious.
Colonel Kong, who flies a stealth bomber over Russia and who has got the bomb. And Peter Sellers felt he couldn't do that part. It was a southern, very southern sort of Texan type. But Steve is playing that role as well. So he's going one better than
Sellers. Dr. Strangelove. Famously, he appears very late in the films.
So and we thought, let's get him on early.
Oh, I mean, good.
At one point, the president is speaking to Dr. Strangelove. Right. And we've had to kind of go through many hoops to make that happen. In fact, the president, Dr. Strangelove, says over a tannoy, shall I come to where you are? That might be useful. And the president says, well, they'll be useful in one way. And the audience always, there's always a huge laugh at that because they wonder, how is that going to work? Yeah. But anyway, yes.
The production, of course, reunites you with Steve Coogan, who you've known a very, very long time.
Yes.
You haven't grown bored of him yet, anyway, that's for sure.
No, we kind of, it's weird. We meet to do work together and then we, you know, go off and do our stuff. We don't sort of hang out. Mm. Not because we, you know, it's
don't have time, by the looks of your workload.
Well, yeah, but also, yeah, we're busy. But also, you know, when we're doing things like Partridge, we are spending like days and after days for a whole year in a room with each other. We probably see more of each other than we do of our families at that point. So, and I think part of the joy of it is things like Alan Partridge, which has been going now for, I think, nearly 30 years. Mm-hmm. We only ever take out of his box every 3 or 4 years. So there's room for him to have grown and moved into a new venture every time we go back to Partridge.
Very nice. Steve Coogan, we claim him as our own because he is an Irish citizen. He has a passport now. Any plans? You have Italian connections. Mm-hmm. That would be surely a route into the EU for you if you wanted to.
Oh, yes, I ought to explore that. But I'm very disorganised. It involves a lot of organisation and form filling, which I'm very bad at.
Well, it took Steve years indeed for his passport. The people look, the film, obviously you can be a massive fan, but if you're not so familiar with it, you can go and just
and if you're a huge fan of the film, you know, your favourite bits will be there, but there will be lots of new stuff as well. Some of it based on some of the earlier drafts that Kubrick wrote that then didn't quite make it, and some of it is our own invention.
So it's
in the voice of the film.
It's like an homage then in many ways.
Well, it's sort of, you know, I noticed this when we were adapting David Copperfield, one of my favourite novels, for the screen, and it's like you can't treat it like a precious artifact. You know, you have to do your own thing with it, but you have to always, as you're adapting it, remember what it was about the original that made you so enthusiastic about it in the first place. So if you capture and preserve the spirit of the original but inject it with new stuff that doesn't feel alien to it, that feels part of it. I mean, one of the nicest things was one of the Kubrick family were at the rehearsals, and she said to me, there's a line in it that I couldn't remember if it's in the film. I thought it was in the film. I went back and watched the film. It's not in the film. And I thought, good, we've done our work well here, because if you can't tell new and what isn't.
It matches exactly the tone of everything. Speaking of citizenship and everything, you obviously have Italian heritage.
Yes.
Your dad, Italian, never became a British citizen, I gather. Is that
true? No, that's true, yes. I mean, I asked, I said, and he fought, you know, at a very young age, he was about 16, 17, he wrote for an anti-fascist newspaper against Mussolini, and during the war became a partisan and had to take on a whole new identity and came over to the UK after that. And I said to him, he died when I was quite young, but I remember saying to him, why have you never voted in a British election? He said, the last time I voted, Mussolini got in, you know, so okay. Which, you know, indicates, you know, democracy is not this kind of thing in aspect that always remains as static.
That's right.
You've got to keep nourishing it and keep renewing it. Otherwise, you know.
There's also hope sometimes when something goes wrong that you're going, well, it mightn't last very long.
Exactly. Yes, yes. As long as they haven't changed the rules to make sure to ensure they can't get out again.
What a way to inspire apathy. You know, the last time I voted, Mussolini got in.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, when you say things like he wrote for an anti-fascist newspaper, he was a partisan in Italy, then he comes to Scotland. And like many Italians coming to these islands, they end up working in the food industry.
That's right. Yes. They? I mean, he did all sorts of things. You know, he was a joiner for a while and a kitchen, made kitchen fittings. And then he and some friends opened up a pizza factory, and it was a pizza making. So there was a huge, big Heath Robinson-esque machine that went the length of the factory that made the pizzas. And you saw the dough coming in at one end and then the tomato going onto it and the cheese and then the toppings that come off the other end and out to the shops. And that was his last venture, yeah.
Because we've huge heritages in Ireland. When I mentioned to English people, actually, they always look at me confused going, say the Italians are running all the fish and chip shops here.
Yeah.
Chippers, we call them. Chippies.
Yeah, chippies. And it's weird because, you know, whenever I hear a kind of stereotypical view of Italy, it's then thwarted by the fact that when people ask me what my dad is, I said, yeah, well, he had a pizza factory. So fair enough.
start with the anti-fascist
stuff.
But they'd spread across in Scotland. So Glasgow was home for you. That was your upbringing.
Yeah.
And I believe there was an Irish priest very important in your life at one stage.
Oh, Irish priest. Well, there were several priests. I went to a school that was part Jesuit run, really.
Very
so that who's the Irish priest that you're getting? Well,
you were thinking of going into the priesthood.
Oh, I see.
Stage,
yes,
and
yes.
You heard
yes.
a voice through a confession box.
Oh, I know. I know what you're getting at here. No, I never wanted to go into confession. I was very kind of obliging and dutiful and, you know, did my regular mass and so on. But I was very bad at confessions. And then I thought I'd better go. And I said, it's been 17 weeks since my last confession. From behind the grill, I just heard, you devil, you. You devil, you know. And it just really shouting at me. And I remember leaving. I was only about 12. I remember coming out thinking, well, that's the last time I'm doing that.
Okay,
who does he think he is to kind of have a go like that at a 12-year-old?
Yeah.
I should have jumped up and down in the church. I'm 12. I'm only 12.
I'm also thinking of how angry a priest in Ireland would have been to be sent to Glasgow. Because they would have been sent.
Oh, yeah. It was that special penance.
That'll calm you down.
I do remember when the papal visit in Glasgow, in Scotland in the early 80s, some minister in Scotland, when the Pope was talking about politics, and some ministers in Scotland said, I wish this Pope would stop pontificating. I thought, well, if he's allowed to do one thing, it really is that.
He owns that word.
He does own that word. His only job is to pontificate.
Just by being here, you've got lots of messages coming in.
Mm-hmm.
One is actually from one of our great comedians here, Kevin McGahern.
Uh-huh.
He says, my granny's nephew, Joseph Carney, taught art in Glasgow and showed me a drawing he did of Armando when he was a young student.
Yes. Wow.
Do you remember that?
I do indeed. Yes. He was the good art teacher.
Okay.
No, we were split up into two. The year was split into two. And I had the other art teacher who I just found a bit. And it was just alphabetically, and I was just on the wrong side of the alphabet. And Joel Kearney, the other half of the class were having a great time and doing fantastic stuff. And there was just one week, I remember, when our art teacher was off ill and we got Joe. It was great. I'm desperate to know what Joe's up to now.
Okay. Well,
there we go. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, he picked me out. I had to sit and be drawn by the rest of the class. Yeah.
Can you please ask Armando when a new series of From the Outhouse will come out? One of my favourite audio series. I've been trying out the Partridge in Me with my friends. It usually goes down well in pubs, says Adrian.
I know it's been recorded now, so I think it should be out soon. I think it's the Oast House, isn't it? The Oast
the
House.
The Oast House.
You were talking about Partridge. I mean, there's so much Partridge happening now, and there's a new team of writers, well, the last 10 years, really, the Gibbons twins.
Right, yes.
It's taken on a whole new lease of life. So now bits of Partridge project drop, I believe they now say, without my being aware that they've been made. So I'm a bit like a listener and a viewer now, watching Alan, not knowing what he's going to say next.
But he's kind of ended up where you imagined him at the very beginning, daytime presenting, it would seem.
Yes. It's funny how it comes. Yeah, he's got his dream. And that's the thing. You know, I mentioned that, you know, every 4 or 5 years he comes out and we give him a new lease of life. But whenever I bumped into Steve intervening in between those moments, we would always speculate as to what Alan is up to. So we were always running this kind of 30-year timeline in our heads as to it. So there's whole things have happened to Alan that you don't know about, but only Steve and I have discussed, and we know when it happened.
He's probably the only Middle Englander who has survived Brexit as well.
Yes. And he tries to tell himself that he's much more kind of liberal-minded, and although the Farage thing, I think, is now making him think I needn't have been. He was putting a lot of effort into sounding liberal and kind
absolutely,
of
absolutely, yeah,
mindful
for a time. Speaking of audio series, Strong Message Here is a very enjoyable BBC Sounds thing. I mean,
you've
got so much output. It's
so, yeah, so this is a podcast I do with a journalist, Helen, who is once a week, and we look at political language. We just take a phrase that's been in the ether that week and just see where it goes, you know. So we've just recorded, in fact, I think in about 4 minutes on Radio 4, the new one will be going. But if you miss it, we actually do a longer version that goes out on BBC Sounds. So there's a 15-minute on Radio 4 and a 30-minute then goes on. And we were looking at Trump. We were looking at Trump. Trump derangement syndrome, which apparently is a thing. If you attack Trump, his supporters will say, well, you've just got Trump derangement syndrome.
Very
as if somehow that just explains it. Yeah. No further questions, you know.
I was reading last night about flooding the zone.
And that's what he's been doing, signing all these executive orders. The philosophy behind that, the strategy is like, just keep saying and doing stuff. Doesn't matter what it is, no matter how crazy, just keep pumping it out.
Overwhelm the opposition.
Overwhelm, because they won't know which bit to pick up and shout about. There's just too much, and that's how you flood the zone.
We have loads of phrases in Ireland. Is stroke politics a thing they use in England?
No, I think that would get you arrested. What's stroke politics?
It's a tradition, you know, where you have TDs and ministers, TDs being our MPs and ministers, who kind of pull off a coup for their own very small parish to do something to further their careers. And the opposition goes, stroke politics.
Stroke? Now, where's the origin of stroke then?
What's stroke would be kind of pulling a stroke.
Giving you a little string over a confidence. So that's pork barrel in America, isn't it? Pork barrel.
Yes,
politics,
yes.
When you get funds for a bridge to be built in your district, even though there's no water or railway lines for it to go over.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. We will not be found wanting is one, but I think that pops up every now and again.
Yes. The other one is like, I make no apologies for, and then they say something that actually sounds awful.
Which they should be apologising for.
Yeah.
Or generally your Henry Kissinger episode, which is about, you know, apologies that aren't apologies. Mistakes were made.
Mistakes, that's right. It's the art of giving the passive apology so that it doesn't sound like you. Sounds like you're apologising, but when you look at the language, you're not apologising. You're saying, you know, instead of saying, I'm sorry if I offended you, I'm sorry if you were offended. That was never the intention.
Yes, it's very conditional.
Yes, exactly.
If you happen to be offended.
And almost like it's your fault for being offended by something. You know.
There were kind of specific ones as well. We've entered the word gooboo into the English language, which we have seen in British political commentary the odd time. It's an acronym, mm-hmm. Grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre and unprecedented, spoken in 1984.
Uh-huh.
Very good year to coin a phrase.
Exactly.
And it was 1982, sorry, I have to correct myself. Where basically there was a manhunt for a double murderer, who eventually, you know, the nationwide manhunt, who shows up in the Attorney General's.
Okay.
A building owned by him.
That's not a good look. Yes, I suppose. I mean, we got got, from the thick of it, we got a word in the, it was the Oxford English Dictionary's word of the year, which was omnishambles.
Amazing word.
It was at that point I thought I'd better stop the show now because, it was people were quoting it in Parliament and stuff.
It even became a Romney shambles for Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney, yes, that's right.
Excellent.
There was an acronym that Trump used the other day, which, and I've got to be careful because I know we're live, which is FAFL. Which is F, I won't tell you what F stands for, F, around, find out. Which means if you annoy me, you'll learn the consequences pretty soon.
Right.
And he posted that after he was trying to get planes with returning illegal immigrants to land in Colombia. Colombia refused. He said he'd impose 50% tariffs.
Yes.
They backed down. And he posted an AI-generated photo of himself as an American gangster from the 30s.
He loves AI pictures with, of himself.
With FAFL underneath.
He wouldn't obviously know what any of that.
Yeah, it's a bit like Kavulvi or something, wherever it was.
It's like Snafu, isn't it?
Snafu, there you go. Yeah.
Situation normal, all effed up.
Mm.
It's like when I started directing stuff,
whenever I changed my mind about something, so I said, let's start over there and then we'll pan the camera. No, can we move that? I'd hear everything with crews saying DFI that. That's a DFI on that one. And after several months, I said, what is this DFI? Is it some technical? Oh, no, it means different F idea.
So that could go forever.
Yes.
Basically, that podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, for sleaze is the word they use over there. We would, brown envelope often comes up.
Brown enveloping, yes. One that's emerging is miserabilism.
Oh, right.
It's hard to say early in the morning. Miserabilism, which is that thing of talking down prospects, saying the economy's terrible.
Oh, yes.
We inherited a mess.
Okay, yeah.
Nothing is working. It's all broken.
We've been here.
With
shoulders to the wheel and pull on the green jersey.
Green jersey, high-vis jacket and shovels on the ground was what our Chancellor was announcing yesterday. Shovels on the ground.
It makes it sound like they're doing it.
I know. It sounds very active and energetic, pulling the levers of growth, as if somehow there's a button in her under her desk that says growth,
We had someone promising to be transparent with the Irish people at one stage and was frankly saying, Paddy likes to know what the story is.
Oh, dear. That begs so many questions. Yes. I think it was Nick Clegg when he was Deputy Prime Minister in the UK said, I've got a sense of direction and I want to take that sense of direction all around the country.
Yeah, everywhere he goes. Someone says, my most disliked bit of political speak is, let me be very clear.
Let me be very clear here. The contextualisation of the infrastructure project will not be undermined by the overriding prospects of a downplay in economic growth. And I'm very clear about that.
It's very clear.
Yeah.
I understand everything. The next politician that tells us we're an island nation should be instantly dismissed. I learned this fact in national school, but it is a catch-all term. It's almost that we can't do anything. Well, we're an island nation.
Yeah. You've got to build. You've got to build out so that you kind of reach the continent, continental Europe. That's what you're going to have to do.
They even use that in Britain, even though it's connected to the continent.
Tony Blair, when he was prime minister, at one point said, "We are a young country."
Right.
No, we're really not.
Years of uninterrupted.
That. So I don't know what that was about.
Listen, we're very excited to see your co-adapted version of Dr. Strangelove and poor old Steve Coogan, who you're working to death on the stage.
No, he's well recovered now, and he's in his element. Actually, it's a real treat to behold.
Someone is asking, how could anyone seriously follow Peter Sellers? Well, if there was one person in the world,
exactly,
it's Steve.
What I'd say is you'd have to go and find out.
That's a good point. He's ever the salesman, of course. Armando Iannucci, thank you so much. Enjoy your time in Dublin.
Thank you very much.
Day. Bye. With each encroaching year of this century feeling like the last one every time, comedy is a very critical public service. And our guests this morning are the busiest people in this very revered high art form right now. They started their comedy lives online and now they're into the second season of their sketch show, No Worries If Not, which is on RT2 Thursday nights. And it's also on the RT Player and YouTube forever, I presume. And it's really good. Really, really good. Like the one about the board game that sums up everything going wrong in Ireland right now. Irish Monopoly, friends.
Introducing Irish Monopoly, the board game you all know and love, now with the hallmarks of home.
Is this right? There's not nearly enough houses in here. You have been awarded a lucrative government contract for a bike shed. Charge whatever you want.
You are suffering from bad mental health. Go to the HSE waiting list for 18 months.
Build your property empire with some of Ireland's famous infrastructure.
I want to buy the National Children's Hospital. How much is it?
It just says TBC. Keep throwing cash in the money pit.
Ah, you landed on one of my streets. Time to put my landlord hat on. You need to pay your rent.
But I have no money left, boys.
Enjoy the roller coaster of living in Ireland.
You are saving for a mortgage. Go directly to your parents' box room.
Irish Monopoly. A game for everyone. Well, whoever's left.
You have given up. Move to Australia.
And they did. There you go. That's why there are no protest movements in this country, because the angriest people are here and they're channeling it all yeah. into comedy. Three of the No Worries If Not team are in the studio. Justine Stafford, who's from Meath.
I am indeed.
Michael Fry, who's from Meath as well.
Yeah, it's yeah.
And Killian Sunderman is not from Meath.
It's important to get some townie representation in the media.
Yeah.
Not from Meath, but you love hedges.
I do.
Or as they call them in Meath, ditches.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, Justine, I want to start with you, because when you're sending up various characters who are obviously inspired from your native Knobber, and when you're using your Knobber nouns, those of us from South Monaghan, and I think people from North Louth and East Cavan, we're all kind of thinking, wait a second, you know, Meath people, you're too posh to be muscling in an hour.
You see, I'm very much on the border of all three counties, so I get a hybrid of an accent which incorporates all of them, and I would have grown up going out in Louth and Monaghan as well, so that's why me and Michael's accents are so different, because I grew up in the ditches, you know, whereas you were in a town.
I wouldn't even know what a ditch was. And Navan, which is very deep.
Very deep.
It's kind of it's posh Meath in the essence of poshness from the
I think it's as posh as Meath gets. Yeah. Deep in the sense that we have a massive lead mine underneath, so deep into the earth. Yeah.
Which goes all the way to Tipperary, but anyway, that'll blow all our minds if you ever think about that. But also, you're the comedian from the south with the best northern accent.
Yeah.
Bar none.
Yeah. My mother is from Donegal, so, and the Derry side of Donegal. So I think when you're a comedian, your first impression is your own mother. So I've spent years and years perfecting that, I think.
Yeah. That's kind of lovely, Donegal, then, isn't it? The Derry side, kind of like slender vowels, musical.
Yeah. It's very like Daniel O'Donnell, kind of very lax and laid back and very calm. Yeah.
So you've basically been doing an impression of your mum for a year.
The whole time. Yeah. So I've made a living off it. So here we are.
That's pretty good. But you also went to college up there, up in the north.
I did. I actually worked for Tourism Ireland in Coleraine. So, so I didn't even go to college up there. It was kind of like I was way too old to be hanging out with college students. And
Tourism Ireland has an office in Coleraine.
It does, yeah.
What do they do?
We promote the north of Ireland for tourist activities, and it's beautiful up there. So if you ever want to do...
Is that HQ of in the north?
In the north, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So if you want to do the Causeway Coastal Route, for example, or the Carrickarede Rope
he's
Bridge...
He's off now.
Yeah, he has the spiel learned off. Yeah.
Or the Giant's Causeway, or any of the Game of Thrones locations. Or there's actually loads to see up there. So
Radio 1 listeners, they're too southern. They don't see the north. They're not going there.
Well, they should.
They've seen the ad and went, oh, I've seen the Giant's Causeway, the Rope Bridge. And Killian, you don't have any of these lovely Meath and Donegal things, but you are 3/4 German, I think I've calculated.
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly it. So I have the German accent, which is, I mean, it's not soft and... That's my impression. Is this okay? No. Am I coming out Scottish?
All right, Braveheart. Yeah.
The Antrim Coast.
Freedom. No, it's more. I have made a living off my dad's accent, which is more like,
oh, what are you on the television? Are you talking to Oliver? You tell him I saw him one time at the shopping centre.
That's kind of thing.
I have a good German name as well, so he's probably your dad is 100% German. Fully.
He's full 100%. Then my mum is 50%. So that adds that together, and I don't know, my Leaving Cert maths is helping me. That would be 75%.
And then you were born in England, so you managed to upset everybody.
You managed to slip that in.
Oh, sorry, that wasn't in the marketing material.
He's a very thorough researcher. I do not expect to be blindsided here.
Very good team.
But yeah, no, I was born in England, but we moved over when I was about 3 or 4. So I mean, I basically grew up here.
Yeah, so you probably felt like an outsider and felt lesser as a result of that, whereas we just wanted to be you. Do you have all of this, you know, citizen of the world stuff that's going on?
I guess it's kind of, for a comedian, it's good because you're growing up with this, your family are doing things one way, and then you're seeing the world around you operating in a different way, and you're seeing your dad not understand sarcasm, and you find that very funny, and you can see things like that happen. So, I mean, it's really good for me because I can kind of see these little cultural differences and pick them, and then turn them into what everyone is saying is one of the best sketch comedy shows that has ever been made.
It is really good.
Oh, thank you.
It's really good. And I can't look at you without thinking of Germans being asked, would they like a piece of cake? And sketch you must look up online if you're not familiar with that. Not to mention the hedges, which we'll come to as well. Okay, right. No worries if not, because he's making me do the marketing thing. Loads of sketches. Like, it moves very fast. Lots of different things happening all of the time. It's doing a mega business online. Obviously, it's on TV, the RT2. The RT player numbers are flying. So the internet has brought sketch comedy back fully, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's people, you're kind of thinking, we're so used to consuming so much on our phones. Will it work if it is on a TV screen? So, like, I think we learned from season one kind of a lot in that process of what did work and what didn't work. And we went into it, very more clued in, I guess, for series two, of thinking, right, we can expand on these kind of things and get all the old men and old women characters in there as well. Yeah, yeah. We all have them ready to go. So I think that was the benefit of season one, having that under us.
And it must be a delight for you, because you would have been filming, editing everything yourself, and now you've got a TV crew to do that for you. It's momentarily.
Like, it's like a learning process in itself doing that, because you're so used to doing things on your own, and then you're like, things you wouldn't even consider of, like even the Monopoly sketch, or there's a sketch of like a gang where, there was makeup and art department having to put trifle around a gun repeatedly, and it kept melting, and that was a big struggle on set that day, it was like the cream is melting on the trifle. So it's,
I mean, to throw cream over Justine about three times and to wipe it off each time, so it was what a weird day.
And it's hard not to break when cream has just been splattered on your face.
Yeah. This was Aidan Gillen, your Aidan Gillen, the second best known Aidan Gillen on the planet.
Yeah. I'd argue first.
Yeah, possibly first. I mean, your producer came up to us earlier. He's like, oh, we're going to have Aidan Gillen. I was like, oh no. He's going to see me. He's going to meet me. Oh no. But he's not here, thankfully.
Because you do a lot of acting now since you took off a couple of years ago. So have you met Aidan Gillen?
No, I've never met him. And everyone seems to have spotted him around like Dublin 8. He's like the Bigfoot of Dublin 8. Everyone's like, I've seen him. And I don't know.
You're the only one who...
I think he's a myth, yeah.
Here I am, Michael. Hello. Are you going to attempt your Aidan Gillen, Michael? I dare you, Killian. Well done. We had Aidan Gillen in the studio before Christmas, and I was dying to ask him, but he's just so polite.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel right to kind of...
I've heard he's lovely as well, so I feel bad, but not bad enough to not do it. So, yeah.
He lives here. His whole family is here. I mean, that is guaranteed he has seen the Aidan Gillen.
Yeah.
But, space-time continuum would collapse.
If we ever met each other,
traditionally, the non-RT media tend to, bash any RT shows. But you've actually broken the mold, and you got a good review from the hostile media that can be sometimes referred to.
And
got a good comedy review. Like, unheard of.
Incredible. And also, Zig and Zag.
Yeah, Zig and Zag liked it.
It's the best thing they've seen on RT in a long time. So we're breaking barriers all around here.
That's the line that you've printed out, is it?
Completely. Yeah. But equally as well, in the review that we received, it was like, so positive about it. And also they said, the young cast. I was like, what a win for all of us involved. Yeah. We're all young here.
We're literally babies.
Yeah. No,
we say good review, but the line was an RT sketch show that isn't an embarrassing disaster. And it's like, do you know what? That's brilliant.
We'll take that. That is a win. And we're young.
Yeah, Use that on the posters.
Yeah. Yeah. Not an embarrassing disaster.
That's all I could hope
My
for.
My dad.
I don't want to deflate, but young comedians, because most, I don't know if you noticed, TV critics tend to be bet down, So that might be the reason. Now, you all know each other extremely well anyway, don't you? So, Justine, you went to college with Killian.
Yeah.
And you worked with Michael in
Joe.ie.
For a year,
Which used to put out sketches nonstop all the time.
It did. It was kind of at a time when Joe was changing, and we brought Michael in to make more sketches. And it was great to get to like work with you to do like social things. And it was at a time when social media and kind of creating things was just kind of still in its formative years. And to see where it's gone from there is wild.
Then I came along.
And then Killian came along.
It all just changed.
Which is wild because we did like film and broadcasting in college together. And then kind of like I was, you know, doing short films and stuff. And then you went off to New York.
Yeah, I was in New York trying to make it big in the Big Apple.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then...
In comedy?
No, just trying to make a living. working in a bar. I hope that the Border Patrol is not listening to this, actually, because technically was just on a holiday, actually, just a nice holiday, looking at the Grand Canyon for 2 years straight. It was so wonderful. The sights.
Constantly renewing his Esther.
But I remember seeing sketches you were starting to make and being like, this is incredible. And it would have been when you were only starting and I was like, Killian is about to absolutely blow up. And then you did.
Thank you very much.
And it was kind of looking into hedges, as you know them.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of, I guess it was during COVID and everyone was under lockdown and wasn't able to move outside their 2K radius. And my 2K radius was rural Ennis, rural Clare, and it was just hedges and ditches and fields and things like that. And I went a bit mad, but I think everyone did. And I started pointing at ditches and hedges and sort of reviewing them and talking about their merits. Mm-hmm. And I think because everyone had lost their collective mind, it went crazy. I mean, it really went mad viral. I was in New York again last year and some woman was walking her dog and she came up to me and she was like, are you that guy that like points at the hedges? And I think she was also like looking at me like, are you safe to be walking around? Like, is this okay? But yeah, I don't know. It just happened somehow.
It was just your existential dread looking into hedges, I think, that really captivated the mood.
If you look long enough at the hedge looks back at you, I think Yeats once said.
You see, that was poetry 100 years ago. Now it's just comedy. We have very strange attitudes. Okay, so you just looked at hedges and became instantly famous. Justine had to work incredibly hard at one stage you're in school making a short film in Limerick and you hear laughter behind you at one of your films.
Yeah, I was about 15 years old and I think that was my first experience of, you know, I was always making comedy shorts. And the best feeling to me was like you'd go to screenings and when people laughed that they got the joke, I was like, this is the best feeling ever. And there was this really specific, irritating laugh. And I was getting like, oh my God, people aren't going to be able to concentrate on the film now. Because it was like, that's a terrible. Yeah, it was like that. And it happened like twice. And I was like, bloody hell. And I was looking at my friends and I'm like, do you hear that? So I was like, yeah. So it happened a third time during my film. And I turned around. It was Pat Short laughing at my film. And I was like,
the entire way through.
The entire, and I was like, I'm going to go. Like, I've peaked. I'm going home now. Oh, I'm going to call it a day. You know, where do I go from here? So that was just, and then mom wanted to get a photo with him afterwards of me with him. But it was my mother. I didn't get the technology from her because she had the camera facing her before selfies even existed on a disposable camera. So the
picture
photo
of you and Pat Short is just of your
is
mom.
My mother's eyes.
Pat, I was, because you do a lot of very good creepy laughs, Justine, in your work, I was going, is this the Pat Short inspired this film?
But it's so funny because Michael is saying, you know, I think your first impression is your mother. I think my first impression was just old men from like the country, just like that kind of rural accent that you encounter, those kind of characters growing up who talk at you. You kind of, I've come to the conclusion, I have a hello, how are you face, where they don't feel threatened, they feel they can talk at you, you're not going to interrupt. And
so you're sitting there minding your own business and there's always a character who just comes at you and uninvited.
And you get their life story with like incredible detail. And I love it. But it's been mad sharing those videos because I thought this was quite a unique experience. But it's...
Is there
universal.
Something about the Meath accent, though, lends itself to a good...
I think it does. The second I start going home, you know, I get into the... You know, I'm on the road for Navan, pretty much, and my jaw starts dropping down and my accent is entirely different when I'm at home. You know, because I had to learn to enunciate when I went to college because no one could really understand me.
That's how she talks after a few pints as well.
Yeah. Just the jaw loosens out. And
Well, I remember coming off the buses, there was always some owl... We kind of known as the town owl. alcoholic, as though there was just one. Mm. And there would be no hello or introduction. They would just go straight into whatever fact they think they have in their head, which is no
bearing. Yeah, no, I love the one as well. They'll come at you and be like, can you believe I'm 71? And you're like, I can actually. Yeah. I can. I don't think this is a shock to anyone. But I love your approach on it. I love your outlook. It's incredible.
In fact, younger. You look a lot older.
No, you're exactly what 71 in my head looks like, given what you've probably done to your body in the meantime.
But I love it. And also because we got to do the Granny's Den sketch, which was we were all made up as elderly women. Mm. And I was like, do you know what? Things are looking all right for us in the future. It's like, if I age like this, it might be all right. Just like
very, Michael, you do a very good older woman.
I do.
You seem to inhabit that comfortably.
Yeah, it's. I felt very comfortable. I felt right on that set. And it was the same with Justine when she was in the old man stuff. I've never seen her so happy and content as when she was a bald old man. And I was like, I think this is for you.
Eating ham and raw sausages out of her pockets.
Living the dream.
The old man eats the ham out of her. But Granny's Den, initially you're going, oh, this could be ageist. This setup that has grannies instead of drags. But you give the grannies a lot of power in this scenario.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they do have a lot of power. You think of grannies and elder people in your life, that, you know, that moment where they slip the fiver into your hand and say, don't tell your mother. Mm. That is powerful. Mm. And the eye contact that's locked in that moment, you know, you wouldn't ever dare tell your mother that they'd given you the fiver. You wouldn't.
Yeah. They harbour secrets that nobody really knows how to unlock except other grannies.
Yeah.
Or maybe you arrive at a certain age and go, now I will know the things that... And I'm not going to pass this information.
And that's why they were the dragons. You know, they do. Mm. They have that power. And how intimidating they made poor Sean on set. Mm. Emma in particular was really...
Emma's unbelievable. Yeah.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. Sean was very scared coming into Granny's Den that day. And he had to work for it.
Very good geographical balance as well, because that was the Dublin granny, Northern granny.
That was, I think they decided on the day. It was like, everyone needs to sound different. But Emma had us driven demented because she kept saying, your mammy would be very proud of you, over and over again, just to stay into it. So like,
you get her saying this phrase, scoopy eyes.
Yeah,
I don't know what it means. I've never heard anyone ever say it, but she goes, lovely scoopy eyes.
Oh, I do have a clip. I'm looking here. Yes, rather than just talking about it, we will let people hear Granny's
first up to face is computer coder Dick O'Shaughnessy. But can he crack the code of impressing the grannies?
Hello, grannies.
Oh, look at him. Little fella.
I'm Dick.
Oh, Dick.
And my company is called Cyberdude.
Cyberdude.
We've all been there, surfing the web, and then...
Dick has lost his nerve. Has he also lost the grannies?
He's nervous.
He's nervous.
Don't be nervous.
You're doing very well, Dick.
Yeah.
And you're very handsome. Isn't he very handsome, girl?
Oh, so handsome. Lovely little face, Dad.
Strapping, young man.
You're great. Go on, you're fine.
Thanks.
Granny Breed has seen enough.
I'd like to make an offer.
Already?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm offering you a pinch of the cheek for a bit of your company. Either this weekend or next weekend, whenever you're free.
Okay, thank you. Wow.
I'd give you an offer as well, and I'll pinch your cheek, but then I'll give you a kiss, and it'll be very wet and very close to your mouth.
That's shocking.
And for that, I want 100% of your company. But only on Tuesday nights when I'm watching Emmerdale.
Oh, she's desperate.
I love how that's cut, that there's no spoiler to reveal.
Yeah, you don't know who he's going.
Quite an offer comes in.
Find out on Thursday.
Art negotiations, Killian, this is something based on a real thing that really exists, I think.
Arse negotiation is about how much arse should be in the movie. Mm. I guess with Hollywood and just films, whenever there's nudity in them, that has to be negotiated. That's like a clause, a part
a real
of the contract.
Thing.
Yeah, it's a real thing. And I thought it would be funny if it was just like about me and like my arse and how much of it would be in the movie. And but it's like this kind of almost succession style business talk, like how much butt is in the movie and all this kind of stuff. But it's just a man and his arse. And that's what it is at its essence.
Now, we're really portraying you as an egomaniac. I noticed the housing crisis is definitely a theme. We've had the Monopoly sketch there played already. Making love while still living with your parents is also a beautiful thing.
Yeah, well, it's a thing that that's a sketch Emma wrote, but it's kind of about, it's something called the silent ride, which anyone living with their parents has had to perfect. So it's a sort of a more muted version of events. I don't know how to say, this is breakfast radio. I don't know how to talk about this in,
You're doing very well.
A more muted.
Go no further.
Gymnastics. Very little squeaking and...
But there's fury here as well, you see, isn't there? And you're obviously generation most affected, so you must be. Mm. When you're sitting in the writer's room, you want to channel that energy in this direction.
Mm, exactly, yeah. I mean, I think that with the Silent Ride sketch, it flips and then you can hear the parents through the wall doing their... You know, they're not being as respectful, I suppose, to the other people living in the house. Okay. And we have the wonderful Carl Spain doing that, which is very loud, very visceral and very hard to hear. But it's very funny as well.
Bring it down a notch, Carl. and that's the kind of fury. Sean Burke, who's not here, has not only channeled his fury into comedy, but he's furiously actually emigrated as well and is now living. Yeah. But you're all happily here and...
Yeah, well, for now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things I know Sean has even spoken about. He's at times come back for a lot of gigs over here. But it is something, you know, that you think about of like, would you move? Or, you know, you never know really what's ahead.
You're like tens, hundreds of thousands of people in the country, basically. Like, can we just cling on to the island? We like it here. Please make it work for us, kind of thing.
Maybe a third series or something might keep us in. I don't know.
Yeah.
That would be
funny. There was someone listening who could.
I mean, the Irish Independent is literally kind of calling for it, aren't they?
Yeah.
And I mean, you've been so grateful to the RT player in your sketches. Which is working so well, by the way, that I've watched all of Gavin Stacey recently and I'm making my way through all of Fraser. But anyway, thanks a million for joining us this morning.
Thanks for
It is. It's on telly again tomorrow night, Thursday. This will be the fourth.
But fourth
it's,
episode,
but
yeah.
It's all
yeah.
on the RT player, both seasons. Are there any gigs and stuff you want to promote? No, because you've been too busy making this show.
No, I'm doing a national tour at the moment. So I'm going all over the country. I'm in Limerick next week. Tickets still available for that.
And where will we find the tickets, Killian?
On my Instagram, there'll be a link, or at aviarytalent.com.
Killian Sunderman on Instagram.
Yeah.
Look up Justine Stafford. You'll find Creepy Old Men, which are all Justine in there. And Aidan Gillen lives in Michael Fry's.
Yeah, Instagram. We are one now. He is me. I am him. Yeah.
Do you want to cut to an ad break for us, Aidan, if you could?
Thank you for joining us here on RTE Radio 1. We're now going to go to the ads.
Love it. No worries if not. There you go. Some of our favourite conversations from the past week. It is the end of the podcast, as you know it. If you have interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, sure, pop us an owl email anytime. It's oliver@rte.ie and have a lovely weekend. Slán.